parable of Jesus that Luke shares with us today is not highly rated on the polls. In a survey among Christians with regard to parables, it's likely this story would be missing from the list entirely. Reading this story from Luke's gospel has something of that familiar and yet strange quality. We know it, or it feels like we ought to know it, and yet as we read it, we're not real sure that we know it at all. There's some perplexing and troubling features that make us take a second look. Is this really the story as we remember it? Wasn't there three servants instead of ten? And weren't they given talents rather than pounds? And we certainly don't remember anybody getting slaughtered. There may have been some casting out into outer darkness and wailing and gnashing of teeth, but slaughtered for failing to gain interest on a $20 investment? That seems a little extreme even for our taste today. And it's probably just because of this disturbing picture that Luke's story presents that we almost always quote or allude to Matthew's version of the story. In fact, many preachers are guilty of, when this story comes up in the lectionary, just flipping over to Matthew and saying, after all, it's probably the same story. But there it is on the pages of Luke. And perhaps for that reason, we need to take a closer look at how Luke uses this parable of Jesus and gives it his own special twist. Luke's version appears to be a combination of two stories, one of which may actually have a basis in fact. One story is about a master who goes away after distributing money to some servants and charging them to invest it in his absence. The other is a story about a nobleman who went away to receive a royal commission. Now, this may be in reference to Herod Archelaus, who was hated and opposed by his constituents and who took bloody revenge on his opponents when he received his royal power. That's the part we don't like, is that slaughtering, especially when it ends up with the liturgy that says, these are the words of the Lord, following, kill him and let me watch. Now, truth be told, when people offend us, there are sometimes I think we probably would like to say that. You know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, but do it while I watch. Look at the beginning, verse 11. The message says, when Jesus had their attention, he told the story. Now, if you look back up in the first 10 verses, the story that it follows is the story of Zacchaeus. And in a nutshell, for those of you who weren't here Sunday before last, or last Sunday, Zacchaeus receives forgiveness and acceptance of Jesus and immediately sets out to share the gift with others and to make amends, which did not please the people who were there. And even though the crowd was not pleased with Jesus, he certainly had their attention. If the IRS announced tomorrow that they were going to return four times any monies taken from me deliberately or accidentally, you can bet they would have my attention. And also remember that this story is not an allegory and that it should not be taken literally. That is to say that we should not assign parts to people in the story or be literal about every action. But there are some parallels that we need to look at. What Jesus is saying here is, this is the way we can see the kingdom of God working. You know, all it takes is a brief glance at the world to tell us the truth of Jesus' story. There are those who choose the rule of the world over the rule of the divine. And Jesus is simply saying, there are going to be some unpleasant consequences to those choices. Perhaps he selected these horrible, bloody consequences because for the people of his audience, that was an accurate reflection of life in the first century. Oppose the king, and it's off with your head. The Assyrians were known to impale people who opposed their rule. Jesus said, the kingdom is among you. And every day, you and I make choices that put us on the side of the rightful ruler of life or on the side of the world. And there are consequences that vary in degree of difficulty to the choices we make in life. The real meat of the story, I think, involves the nobleman who called 10 of his servants and gave them £1 with the instruction to trade it until he returned. Now notice a few things. Each one got the exact same amount and the exact same instruction. However, each one was not equally skilled in investment. Notice that the amount is small, but the reward of the investment is great. One was given $20 in today's terms, and he traded it for $200. Another got $20, and he brought back $100. Not an amount that would make very much difference in the nobleman's net worth. And yet, they are rewarded with rule over 10 cities and 5 cities. It's obviously a test. And the servants probably understood this from the very beginning. Skill, courage, and loyalty to the nobleman and his business are to be measured in his absence. Also important is the fact that it's not the time when the nobleman returns, nor is it the amount of money gained by the servants in the trading that's important. The important thing is faithfulness to the mission. The nobleman wasn't angry with the servant because he failed to be highly successful in investments. He was angry because the servant failed to make an effort. So what is it we need to learn from this story? Well, we've all been equally gifted with forgiveness and salvation and faith. Use whatever terms you choose. God has invested each one of us with new life. And with that new life comes obligations. On the mantle at my grandmother's house was a small carving of 3 monkeys on a fence. My grandmother enjoyed sharing with us the folk wisdom of the monkeys. It made a lot of sense. For children, especially. One of the monkeys covered his eyes so that he could see no evil. One covered his ears so that he could hear no evil. And one monkey covered his mouth so he could speak no evil. They were all busy keeping themselves out of trouble. Now, some years later, a fuller truth emerged or dawned on me. This monkey theology was not nearly responsible enough for Christian discipleship or for a witnessing church. Too many Christians, I think, understand the goal of religious life to be that of staying out of trouble, not making any, not causing any. We look quite busy tending our personal treasures of holiness and actively falling short of doing business with the things of the gospel. Looking cautious, caring, and busy is not enough. We need to be about the work of the kingdom. Our congregational and our personal spiritual lives can never, ever center on our own persons or on our own institution. We must be busy investing, carrying the good news of Christ, or we are not being faithful. The dean of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg has said, whenever the church is in trouble, it does three things. It fiddles with the structure, it raises new money, and it changes the liturgy. It gives the impression of being very, very busy, but in truth, it's not. And the church in Germany during the 1930s did all three of those things, looking very, very busy, and in truth, it should have been busy opposing the rise of anti-Semitism. We're not here to preserve the faith. We preserve it only when we share it and when we invest ourselves in others. Our job is not just to be busy. We are measured not by our success. Hear this. We are measured not by our success, but by our faithfulness and our obedience. The point is this. To each of us in equal measure has been given the most intimate relationship with God as children of God's family. Through Jesus Christ, God loves us so much that he went straight to Calvary to die for us. Christ is willing to take our chains of guilt on his own hands and his own feet and let them bind him to the cross. He wore the crown of thorns and he suffered scorn from those who refused and who still refuse to have him as their king. With such love, he has drawn us to himself and laid his claim on us as his redeemed. We belong to God. We are God's servants. From this aimless wandering without a goal beyond the grave, from our self-centered ways that know no business but our own, from poverty, God has delivered us and given us a place in which to serve with a noble and enduring purpose and inherit life with capital letters. That's our pound, given each of us in equal measure. Now, gifts and talents have been given us in differing measures. But in this important gift, there are no advantages or disadvantages that anyone has and others do not. Remember, too, how often we suppose with our little pound, little can be done. To light a candle in the corner of our world and the winds that blow across the nations with the force of hurricanes would surely blow it out. If I had a lot of money, people say, or if I were just gifted and important in the power structure, then I could what? The question is not whether we would be more faithful given riches or power or position, but whether or not we are faithful with the pound we have. The spiritual capacity that we have will enlarge as it's used. It will be lost if it's not. Use your gift. Be faithful to your trust. Each of us must take the pound we've been given and invest it. John Powell, an author and Roman Catholic priest, has hanging on his bathroom mirror a sign that he sees every morning as the first thing on the day's agenda. It reads, "Good morning, Jesus. Thank you for loving me. What have you got going today? I want to be
a part of it.
Now maybe we should have that sign on our mirror too. I started to make them and stick them in the bulletin, but you're gonna have enough, so. But I have to confess that often with my mind preoccupied with the daily business of my own, I might fail to see the sign, or seeing it, I might just wish I had. And yet I believe that every day is given us as an opportunity to exercise the spiritual capacity we've been given, to be a part of God's plan in the world, and that whatever plan I have ought never contradict with God's plan. Every day is an investment in God's love, for every day belongs to God, and it is in trust to me. The top line in discipleship is taking seriously our relationship with Christ, at least as seriously as he took his relationship with us. He died for that, you know. So a risk on our part is very appropriate. As Christians, we hear the word stewardship a lot. We're told that we are stewards of the wealth that God has granted us. But how many of us really know what a steward is? A steward is someone entrusted with another's wealth or property and charged with the responsibility of managing it in the owner's best interests. Listen again. A steward is charged with the responsibility of managing another person's wealth or property in the owner's best interest. Now apply that to life. Have we really been managing the money and possessions, the life entrusted to us, in God's best interest? Or have we been merely using what we have been placed in charge of to better our own lifestyle and fund our own retirement while saving a few scraps for the unfortunate? When you entered the church today, you received a pledge card. When you come to the Lord's table, you'll be asked to take a $1 gold piece from the basket here on the altar. That dollar is literally God's money. It was given for this project. It represents your pound. Take it home. Carry it in your pocket. Place it where you can see it every day. It's yours to keep for the rest of your life. But let it remind you that we are God's stewards. All we have belongs to God, and it is only entrusted to us. It's our responsibility to manage it in God's best interest. Then I ask that you think and pray this week about how much of the money that God has entrusted to your management you will invest in this church for the coming year. And then bring your pledge card back next Sunday and we'll offer them together for blessing. If you can't be here next Sunday, get it to me and I'll put it with the rest. And I noticed that there were some already that had been turned in. I assume that those had already been prayed over, and if God changes your mind this week, I can give it back to you. We will put them all together and pray over them. But remember also that as with the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ or any of the others that you want to name, there is a closing bell. When the trading ends and the gains and the losses are computed. In the movie War Games, the computer tells us that the only way to win is not to play. Luke is telling us the opposite. The only way to win is to invest ourselves and what God has entrusted to our care in the kingdom. we are required to play. And thankfully, the gain or loss is not up to us. The question is whether or not those who follow after us will find us faithful in our task of investing for God's best interest. Steve Green has a song that I asked Sandy to learn this week and sing for us. Let the chorus, the words of the chorus, fill your hearts and guide your life. It goes like this. May all who come behind us find us faithful. May the fire of our devotion light their way. May the footprints that we leave lead them to believe. And the lives we live inspire them to obey. May all who come behind us find us faithful. Some of those things happened to me this year. Two things happened especially. And I can tell you that if you talk with me long enough, I will manage to get both of them in. I will tell you about my week at Shades, and I will tell you about my week in the hospital. I must be a slow learner. I hadn't thought about that, because it did make a change. And if we can be that interested and that willing to share those things, why is it so hard for us to say, I go to a church that changed my life. I go to a church that loves me for the way I am. We've set ourselves up to believe that being this steward of God is such a difficult job that only those who have graduate degrees are capable of doing it. It's not true. Each one of you has more influence than your four pastors here who have degrees after their names. Because when people look at you, they see the fire of your devotion that lights your way. They see the footprints that you leave that will inspire them. As we come to this table to do two things, to remember God's love for us and to openly accept our willingness to be God's stewards in whatever God gives us, if it's a dime or 10 million, we will be faithful. Let us prepare our hearts and face it unafraid.